and I will also try to set a good mode of ending on time. I'll be presenting joint work with Judy Miller and Matt Hamilton. Judy is a mathematician at Georgetown University, and Matt is a biologist. And the first thing that I want to do is try to explain what some of the words in the title mean. I'll trust you to know what diffusion and model and evolution mean, but beyond that, I'll have to do a little bit of explaining. So first, what is a quantitative trait? So you remember from high school about Mendel and his pea plants. You had peas which had smooth surfaces or wrinkly surfaces, either or, discrete trait properties. A quantitative trait is something which is not either or. It's not a finite, it's not like there are a finite number of possibilities. It's something where you have an interval of values. So a quantitative trait is a continuous random variable, and examples are the height of a human, the oil content of a corn plant, the tail length of a cat, et cetera, et cetera. And the actual value that a quantitative trait takes on is generally determined by three things. First, you have the contribution from numerous genes, and genes get called loci by a lot of geneticists, so I will alternate, likely. So cats with very long tails tend to have kittens with longer tails than cats who have very short tails. So that's a genetic contribution. There are environmental factors. If you have a population of cats that are intended to have long tails, and they live in a world full of dogs with sharp teeth, then they will, on average, have shorter tails than they might have had if they lived in a different environment. Similarly, children raised during wartime will, on average, end up being shorter adults than they would have been otherwise. And then the third thing are the genetic environmental interactions, and these are the things that we're actually putting our energy into trying to understand with this model. So what are genetic environmental interactions? So this is a cartoon of genetic environmental interactions. It's cats who are living in a world of rocking chairs and tightrope trees. And this is a cat who has a very long tail, and because it's surrounded by rocking chairs, its tail is constantly getting damaged, the cat is stressed out and unhappy, and it is not going to be able to put as much energy into nurturing and raising its offspring. It's not going to be as good at the hunt because it's always at the emergency room, and it's probably not going to do as well on Saturday night as the other cats. By and large, this cat is not going to do as well reproductively as it might wish to, so its genetic material is not going to appear in subsequent generations as much as it might if there weren't those rocking chairs. This cat has a very short tail, and because these cats live on apples, this cat is regularly falling off of trees or stressing out trying to get to apples, and it's also not going to do well for analogous reasons as this cat, but in this case because its tail is too short. And this cat has an intermediate length tail. It's not going to be suffering these stresses or those stresses as much as these two cats, and so this cat is going to do relatively better than those two cats, and its genetic material is going to appear in subsequent generations more than the genetic material of those two cats. So here I'm trying to explain how the environment that the animals live in can have a pressure on the population, which then shows up in subsequent generations through the genetics. So specifically, a population of animals will have a distribution of trait values. So if you do a histogram of the tail lengths of a population of cats, you'll get something approximately Gaussian. There will be a mean and a variation, and that's the distribution of the trait value within the population. The environment that the population lives in will determine some ideal trait value. So there, it would be some ideal trait value. So for example, you have a population of cats where the average tail length is less than the ideal tail length, and most of the cats have suboptimal tail length relative to this ideal tail length. So this ideal tail length is something set by the environment, and this is the situation that the population of cats live in. And the question is, as generations pass, how will the average tail lengths of the subsequent generations move towards the ideal tail length? How will the distribution move towards the right? Because the cats that have longer tails should be doing better than the cats that have shorter tails, and so intuitively you expect this distribution to move to the right as generations pass. So before I get to that question, I should point out that even in the absence of environmental pressure, you're going to get that as population, as, let me say that differently. Assume you have a population of cats where the average tail length is actually optimal, the optimal tail length. Then as the generations pass, you would expect that the cats with this genetic makeup will do better than the cats with that genetic makeup. And so as the generations pass, the distribution of tail length should tighten. And so what you're seeing here is you're seeing a loss of genetic variation. This is because this is what would happen if you did not have something introducing new genetic material into the system. If you didn't have migration, if you didn't have mutation, then as the generations pass, the distribution will get tighter and tighter and tighter, and this could be catastrophic if there was a sudden change in the environment, because this population of cats is going to have far more of the genetic footprint of a population of clones than this population of cats, and they wouldn't be able to respond as well. Separately, if the optimal tail length was longer, then this distribution is going to move to the right in response to the optimal tail length being significantly larger than the bulk of the tail lengths in the population. And so the histogram is going to move to the right and sharpen. And it's quite plausible to imagine that it could stall out and never actually reach that optimal tail length. So what our model looks at is it's going to look at this question, which is, if you have an initial population with a certain average tail length and a certain amount of genetic variation, and there's an optimal tail length, as time passes, how well does the population respond to that genetic pressure, and how does the genetic variance decrease in time? Can it actually achieve the optimal tail length? So that's the overall question. So now I'll give a quick overview of the model. So we're going to consider a quantitative trait that's determined by n genes, n loci. And we'll assume that each gene is diallelic, so it can have one of two configurations. And each gene can have a different effect size. So what that means is that some genes, whether they're in one allele or the other, might have a 2-inch difference on the tail length, whereas other genes, whether they're in one allele or in the other, might have a 1/2-inch effect on the tail size, and a third gene might have a micron effect on the tail size. And so you would expect that if you have a family of genes, each of which has a different effect on the ultimate tail size, and then you have this environmental pressure, that some genes are going to respond more quickly to the environmental pressure than others. And we want to keep track of the fact that they can have different effect sizes. And so that's what the word finite effect in our model means. So imagine that you have 5 genes that determine the cat tail length. And here I've drawn a cartoon where I've just put all 5 on one strand as if it mattered where they were. It might, but we're going to assume it doesn't. So here's the first gene. It has two alleles, a capital A allele or a little a allele, and it has an effect size Q. Capital A, by convention, is the configuration that would make the tail length longer. Little a is the configuration that would take the tail length shorter. And Q1 is that number, 2 inches, 1 inch, a micron, whatever. So each gene has it has two alleles, and it has its own effect size. And in fact, I don't actually care where these genes occur. What I really care about is what fraction of the population has the lengthening allele in the first gene, what fraction of the population has the shortening allele in the first gene, and of course I care about what the effect sizes are. So how do the alleles and the effect sizes determine the tail length or the trait value? So if you have capital N cats, for the jth cat, you can introduce an indicator function, xij. x1j is 1 if the first locus is in the lengthening configuration. It's 0 if the first locus is in the shortening configuration. So for each gene, each locus that has an influence on the tail length, whether that gene is in the lengthening or the shortening configuration determines whether that's a 1 or a 0. So for example, if the jth cat has this genetic makeup, lengthening in the first, shortening, shortening, lengthening, lengthening, the indicator function would be 1, 0, 0, 1, 1. And we'll assume, so being mathematicians, we need assumptions. We'll assume that the trait value is additive and that there are no interlocus effects. So that means that there are no effects between the first gene and the third gene, that you can't have them they basically have independent contributions. So given that assumption, the tail length of the jth cat is just a linear combination of the indicator functions and the effect values. So you have an average tail length, and then you have plus half of the first effect size because it was in the lengthening configuration, minus half of the second effect size because that one was in the shortening configuration, and so on. So given the indicator function and the effect sizes, you determine the tail length. How you determine the effect sizes is an interesting question that has to do, you need to look at the entire population, and that's something I can talk about offline, how you determine those effect sizes. Okay. So let xi be the number of individuals that have the lengthening version of the ith gene divided by the total population size. So it's the fraction of the population that has the lengthening configuration in the ith gene. Now, if you have a gene where this number is equal to 1, so say the first gene has x1 equal to 1, that means that the entire population has the first gene in the lengthening configuration. And therefore, however they mate, their offspring will have the first gene in the lengthening configuration. And their grandchildren will have the first gene in the lengthening configuration. And that's because we don't have migration, we don't have mutation. What you start with is what you're stuck with. And so if the entire population had a particular gene in the lengthening configuration, then that will just stay that way forever. So that would be if one of these equals 1. That would mean that that particular gene has become fixed. Similarly, if the entire population had the gene in the shortening configuration, then all subsequent generations would have that gene in the shortening configuration. That would be if this equaled 0. That would be another way for a gene to become fixed. And so x will take values between 0 and 1. If it achieves 0 or if it achieves 1, then that particular gene has become fixed and it's basically become irrelevant. Now, for the first variant of the model. So we're going to assume that these animals are mating randomly. So this will So basically, whether or not the animals are stressed is going to have to do with how good they are at raising their offspring, not really with how good they are at generating, well, at, yeah. So PI is going to be the probability that an individual in the subsequent generation has the lengthening version of the I allele. And so this will be proportional to the total number of individuals that have the lengthening in the allele in the current generation. So if you have lots of individuals that have the lengthening allele in the I gene, then there, you should have lots of offspring that have that in the I gene. So PI should be proportional to the total number of individuals that have the lengthening version of the I locus. This doesn't have to do with fitness. Separately, the probability that you'll have a child with the lengthening version of the I allele should have to do with the average fitness of individuals that have the lengthening version of the I allele. So this probability will also be proportional to the fitness of the subpopulation that have the lengthening version of the I allele. So omega is fitness. I haven't told you how it's defined or what it is. It's just at this point an abstract number which should be large if the individuals that have that lengthening allele are very fit, and should be small if they're not. Similarly, the probability that an individual will have the shortening version of the I allele will be proportional to the number of adults that have the shortening version and their average fitness. Combining the two and asking that they PI and QI add to one, you can write probabilities, and at this point you could do a stochastic simulation. So the probabilities depend on the fraction of the population that has the lengthening allele, the fitness of that, the average fitness of that subpopulation. It depends on the number of the fraction that does not have the lengthening allele and the average fitness of that subpopulation. So if you start with an initial population, you can find, you can define the vector, which is the allele percentages. So this would be a vector in R5 if there were only 5 genes that determine the tail length. Once you have that, if you have defined your fitness function, you can define the vector P. That's a 5 vector. Given this 5 vector, you use that to generate the next population, the 5 vector for the next population. That determines a new P vector, and so on, and so on, and so on. So at this point, you could just run a stochastic model of your population, and you could watch your vector evolve in time. It gets complicated, though, if you want to try and say something about fixation, or if you have lots of genes or lots of cats, it could be a very slow computation. To define the fitness, we do what's quite standard. We choose a fitness function. In this case, it's just a Gaussian. It's got a mean, and it's got a width, a variance. And so it's centered at an optimal tail length. Kappa has to do with the selection strength. And if you have a particular tail length, then that number right there is the fitness of the individual with that tail length. The individual with the optimal tail length is the fittest, and the way you should understand this is that if an individual has an optimal trait value and their expected number of offspring is L, then for an individual which has a different trait value, you take their fitness and multiply it by L, and that's the expected number of offspring for that particular individual. So if the cat with this tail length expects to have 25 offspring over its life, then a cat with this tail length would expect to have 12 offspring over its life, because you take 25 and multiply it by a number of approximately a half, for example. Our model, we did not want to keep track of individual genes in individual cats, and we didn't want to do stochastic simulations. So we took the number of cats and the number of genes to be large, and we made a diffusion model using fairly standard machinery. And to do that, we introduced a distribution. So phi is a distribution. It has arguments x, q, and t. It's the number of genes that have the allele frequency x and effect size q at time t. And so you can rewrite everything in terms of this distribution. So for example, the average tail length, which before had been written by summing over the number of genes, can be written as an integral against this distribution. And the probabilities can be written without reference to individual genes. And when you derive a diffusion model, you get something which has a diffusion term and an advection term. And the coefficients are right here. Now, intuitively, you expect that the environmental pressure should show up in the advection term, because it's the environmental pressure which is telling the entire population that its tail is too short or its tail is too long, and therefore the entire population is responding to that pressure, and its genetic distribution is either drifting to the right because it's trying to lengthen its tail, and so more and more genes are going into the lengthening allele, and therefore the X values are getting more and more prevalent, the X values near 1 are getting more and more prevalent, or if the entire population has its tail too long, then it's going to be trying to shorten its tail, and more genes are going to go into the shortening allele, which means you get more X values closer to 0. And so it's the term that's going to make the distribution shift to the right or to the left, which should reflect the pressure, the environmental pressure. And that's right here, and this is what came out of the standard machinery. You see that you have the optimal tail length minus the average tail length of the population. The first term is fairly innocuous. It degenerates at 0 and 1, but which is not that innocuous, but it doesn't really have any environmental pressures in it. And so this looks quite innocent until you remember that the average tail length is actually an integral over the entire solution. And so this is actually a non-local differential equation. And so that's nastier than it appears. You have a probability distribution. It has a delta function at x equals 0, a delta function at x equals 1, and then it has a nice smooth function for x between 0 and 1. The smooth function satisfies that PDE I told you about, and the delta functions at 0 and 1, they reflect fixation. Or another way of looking at it is they reflect absorbing boundary conditions of that partial differential equation. So you had that PDE, it's not going to conserve mass, you're going to have mass accumulating at x equals 0 and x equals 1, and that reflects fixation. And so I'd like to show a simulation or two. So this is, first we did a population that had only one effect size. Q is 2.5. It's a number. It's not going to mean anything at the moment. We take uniform initial data, and we assume that none of the genes are initially fixed. So the things that multiply those two delta functions are 0 initially. So this is the initial data. It's constant, and there are no delta functions here or here. As time passes, I should say that the tail length, we took a population which had initially 0 tail length, and the ideal tail length is 0.1. So the population is going to be trying to lengthen its tail on average, and you're going to see the distribution moving to the right. And so as this is time passing, you find delta functions on the right and the left. That corresponds to more and more genes becoming fixed as time passes. the percentage of genes that are not fixed so is getting smaller and smaller. Initially you have no genes fixed, 30% genes are unfixed, 9% are unfixed, 3% are unfixed, 1% are unfixed, and then this is just going to stop changing because if everything's fixed, you can't respond to the environmental pressure anymore. When you look at what got fixed, the more genes got fixed in the lengthening configuration, 38%, than in the shortening configuration, 32%. So one way or another, things are going to be hitting both absorbing boundary conditions because you have that diffusion term, but because of the advection term, you're going to have more things hitting the right boundary than the left boundary. And so you will inevitably have things fixing in the tail shortening allele. You'll just have more of them fixing in the tail lengthening allele. And so you see that you're not going to have the entire population conspiring to mate in some incredibly smart manner so that the only things that get fixed are in the lengthening allele. So now this is time. That's the average tail length. The optimal tail length is 0.1, so that's actually up here. I need to redo this graph. And we did three simulations here. One simulation has the effect size 2.5. That's the one I just showed you. Here, time is passing. The population is lengthening its average tail length, lengthening its average tail length, lengthening its average tail length, and then saturating. It never reached its optimal tail length of 0.1. This is a population which has a much smaller effect size. The genes have, you know, they, instead of having a 2-inch influence on the tail length, they might have a 1/2-inch influence on the tail length. They also respond to the genetic pressure, but they don't do as well. They run out of steam at around 0.08. And here we have half of the genes having one effect size, half having the other effect size, and as time passes, they do much better than you would have expected if you just linearly interpolated the two. So what you're seeing here is you're seeing saturation, which reflects the loss of genetic variance. And analogously, if I had plotted the genetic variance as a function of time, you would see the genetic variance just going to zero. And so it's tapering out to zero, and the tail length is saturating, and you can see how the population responds to the pressure. So basically, to sum up, what we found was, so there's been questions in the literature about, is it the initial distribution of the genetic, is it the initial genetic distribution in the population that matters, or is it the initial total variance in the population that matters? And we did a number of simulations where we tried to address that question, and we found that ultimately it's actually the all that matters is the initial variance, the genetic variance in the population, that you can do lots of different initial distributions, but how a population responds to the environmental pressure has to do with the initial variance, how much genetic diversity it has to work with. So I'll stop.
Any questions, comments?
Yes, Neil. Yes. Yes. That's in general problem when you have this integral, this total thing going in. But it's right. Yes. Yes, I never thought about it that way. You are right. The thing that is at least somewhat more respectable than other models is that at least we have some subgroup that has a well-defined effect size. So like a third of the genes have one effect size and a fourth of the genes have another effect size. Other models don't even have that. And so even though a particular gene is kind of lost in the sea, it's represented as a member of a subgroup that has a particular effect size. So there is that, but it's so it's sort of like subpopulations aren't washed out, but individual genes are. But it's
well, let me start thanking for this invitation. It's my first time in Canada. And it's my first time presenting this talk. I'm lecturing in the Computer Laboratory, which is the Department of Computer Science in at Cambridge University. It takes the name Computer Laboratory instead of the Department of Computer Science because disregarding the new building, it started in 1936 by Leonard Jones, and the name was at that time Mathematical Laboratory. I'm part of the Artificial and Bioinformatics Group, and also with links with the distributed system. I'm affiliated at the Fitzwilliam College, and I'm teaching in the mathematical department at the MPhil in Computational Biology. If we look at the map of HIV in Africa, we recognize that there are multiple strains. The majority of the strains are probably in the birthplace of the virus, around 1950. There is quite a bit of work in theoretical immunology, and I think that this has been started by Alan Peterson from the Los Alamos National Laboratories. Most of the variation that in the HIV virus, it is about the external proteins of the virus and has quite a lot of pathological consequences, as I will show. Let's start from a question. How does one counsel two HIV-infected individuals who are in a monogamous relationship? Do they really need to use condoms? And the answer to this question is it depends. If dual HIV infection is possible, and we know that now it can occur and quite often, and there are two ways in which two strains can coexist. And one is co-infection, in which the infection is double at the same time. So one person with two or more strains infects another person, or superinfection, that is a time-delayed infection. Most of the important variation in HIV is about the fact that the virus, the fitness of the virus, the possibility, the capability of giving offspring, as in the previous talk, depends on the needs of interacting with one receptor. That can be the CXCR4 or the CCR5. The main target overall is the cell CD4, even if I will show that there are more targets for the virus. system biology is now quite a trendy, a buzzword, and but from a mathematical point of view, modeling biological system is not trivial. I remember that this is a cell, is a macrophage that is engulfing bacteria, and there are particles that may, I remember, they are viruses. What is very, I remember that a few years ago, working with theoretical physics department in Florence, modeling a cell or modeling a cow or modeling something else was pretty much considering the object as spherical and then shrinking the object. And if you have the object, you can use one, or if you don't have zero, and they can start with Ising models to model the biological process. If you want instead to add more biology, that is more tricky, and you can use a discrete stochastic, but that can be very time consuming, and you may not have all the biological knowledge to do that, or the Langevin regime, or you can use continuous and deterministic system, like using ordinary differential equations or PDE. Probably is more biologically unrealistic to use ordinary differential equations because cells are very big, and you can use for molecules like oxygens, but cells you don't have probably in so many to use this technique. What we can say about using ordinary differential equations to model biological system is that it gives you an average solution. And if a biological mechanism that you are considering is really robust, you should have some output using even ordinary differential equation. And that gives you also a good feedback about what you will find applying stochastic methods. This is pretty much the system I'm going to deal with. And you have a virus that has some proteins, external proteins, and the digestion of this virus by an antigen-presenting cell will result in signaling. The main actor of the immune system, the main player, the CD4, of the infection. The CD4 will inform of the infection. The CD8, that are killer cells that will kill all the cells that are infected, and will inform the B cells that will express antibodies that are free molecules that will bind and neutralize the virus. A first model about T cell, and can be both the CD8 and the CD4, infected T cell and the virus, can be seen as a bare term and a dead term. And this is about the carrying capacity of the immune system. There is a source that is the bone marrow, and then there is something that is coming from the fact that once the virus has been presented by an antigen-presenting cell to the CD4, the particular CD4 that is able to catch the signal from the antigen-presenting cell will start amplifying and growing in number. The same with the B cell, as soon as the B cell will interact with the CD4, it will start amplifying and produce massive quantities of antibodies. So a first model is a three equation differential equations in which there is both the natural killer process that is about that is this the fact that the infected T cells are killed in the number of infection, and this is the budding of the virus, and also the virus that is killed, that is neutralized by the antibodies. Using this simple system, we are able to find curves that are well known in medical literature, in which this is the time in days, and the T cells in diamonds are decreasing while the infection is progressing. And the upper one is the case of a chronic infection. This one below, in which we consider also the B cell response and the production of antibodies, leads to the defeat of the infection. Let's use a couple differential equations to model several strains of the virus and of the T cells. And this is a mean field approach that will disregard the effect of the fluctuation and the genetic drift. So the T cells equation is pretty much similar to the previous one, that, except that there are several sources, and the gamma, that is the coupling, that is the interaction term between the I cell and the infected I cell and the T cell, or between the virus and the T cell, are not scalar but are vectors, and I will show some of the phase diagrams that are concerning the gamma parameters. So we have I, that is the index for the T cells, and K, that is the index for the infected I cell, the T cells that are infected by the virus of strain K. We can start considering for the gamma a very, let's say, I would say flexible equation, in the sense that we can, changing A, B, eta A, eta A, B, we can really modify and model in a different way the interaction between the strain I and the strain J. We can have just a diagonal matrix or something that is more subtle, depending if the T cell of strain I will recognize not only in a perfect way the virus of strain J, but also near virus that are showing that are very similar to the J. Well, that is just I've probably written too much, but just that the A and B and eta and A controls the shape of this. How we can get better information about the shape of this function? Well, there are several ways, but are still semi-quantitative. In the sense, first of all, from a biological point of view, there are experiments that with a technique that is called two-photon microscopy that tells us about the diffusion rate and the interaction time of T cells, B cells, and viruses. And then we can also work out a bit how much information is in the interaction between a T cell and the target infected cell, or about the virus, the antigen, that is the little piece of a virus that is recognized and is the target for the immune system. And is plenty of literature. What is important is to try to extract and integrate literature from different sources. That can be medical literature or literature from molecular databases like microarray and proteomics. And that is really challenging. And then you can study the phase diagram of A or B and eta of the gamma function. And that is a plot of what happened with multiple strain infection, and it's pretty much similar. This in the inset is the phenotype of a multiple strain. And This is the diagonal of the gamma matrix, while here there is the shape of the gamma is different. You can see that the strains have pretty much a similar, in this condition, a similar behavior. This is the short time in days of the infection, and this is the long time behavior. What is happening if instead of having a co-infection, we have a super-infection? Here is the number of infected cells, and here is the time of the first infection, and this is the time of the second infection. And you can see that is growing very slowly. This is the number of viruses, and the first infection and the number of viruses produced by the second infection is very small. We have, from contacts in the Netherlands and in Milan, we have some emerging evidences about this number, but it's something that is investigated only nowadays. This is what's happening for a second infection going slowly, and when the immune system starts to be weak, like the progression of the AIDS pathology. So the first finding is after superinfection, the quasi species dynamics has time scales of several months and becomes even slower at low number of CD40 cells. And you can device, I will not deal with, been using a bit of statistical mechanics to devise the behavior of the quasi species that are package of clouds of virus genotypes with respect the coverage of the T cell. But I will skip, just to say that that is part of a model. One important biological information that is quite recent is that there are the AIDS pathology starts really one once the virus shifts the target from the CCR5 receptor to this receptor CXCR4, and the mutation of the virus induce the production of receptors that brings the cell to a syncytium, means the different cells will bind each other and will die. Is a suicide behavior of T cells that decrease in a remarkable way the number of CD4 T cells. And you can incorporate the mutation from the CCR5 targeting virus to the CXCR4, the production of this factor F, that is the tumor necrosis factor, that is the receptors that I was showing before. And you can extend the previous model incorporating this dynamics, because this factor, the TNF, also brings to the induce the suicide of the naive T cells, the one that has not been committed to become CD4 or CD8. So this is something that is even before the differentiation between CD4 and CD8. Then you can study, and I will skip the explanation, you can study a bit the targets of this, the CXCR4 and this in the CCR5, to understand what is the rate of evolution of the virus from here to here, and you can incorporate that information from sequence analysis and protein structure into the model. And then you can work out and find the CD4 decrease in time, so this is, since this time are, is a period of months, several months and years, or you can work out what is the best regime of the heart therapy, in the sense that you make the virus, you drop the quantity of virus, and then you can study what is the new strain that will take advantage of this situation. And you can infer if it would be better to target a drug therapy towards a CCR5 receptor virus or towards a CXCR4 receptor. And that is other time evolution in which you can study the superinfection on different conditions of the heart. And I will skip this. The finding with this model is that we are able to describe, to fit very well, medical data on the decrease of CD4 and CD8 cells during AIDS, and by including the expression of this tumor necrosis factor. Very quick, now I'm starting working on a spatial dynamics on multiple strains that will happen in a lymph node, and that is very important because it is part of a AIDS pathology. This is a normal lymph node, and after and while the disease progresses, the lymph node is really shrinks. Other, very quickly, you can study spreading dynamics of HIV. This is, you can start from very simple probabilistic cellular automata. This is the Domani-Kinzel, in which you have the rule that one person is infected depending on the neighbors too or in itself. And then you can study phase transition, chaos, and dynamics on this rule. What you can do is to you can extend this to networks, contact networks like scale-free or hierarchical, and you can even use realistic networks for doing this. What I'm doing is to take into account the social behavior, because if you see that all your neighbors are ill, you start being, well, you start avoiding shaking hands in the same ways that you used to do before. And you start, in some sense, reading. You get a lot of news from the newspaper and the television about a disease that is coming. So the next step, and this is something that I'm doing with a group in the theoretical physics in Florence, is about looking at the phase dynamics in which you have the infectiveness of a virus and some social behavior. That the social behavior can be your neighbors or the fact that you are reading the newspaper and so on. And you can study the phase transition depending on the level of informativeness and on your social behavior. Other things, well, that is part also of the fact that diseases have an incubation period, and you may, in this incubation period, if you are not informed, you can get infected or no. Other things going on is something that I'm probably going to start in the next days with Anna, is about finding how a protein binds to the DNA. And this is about a PDE model of the liver regeneration that I'm studying, in which the liver to grow needs oxygen, and the oxygen is brought by angiogenesis, the vessels that are growing. I will be happy of discussing this in the next days, and this is my small group. His husband and wife and a baby, so I feel like an uncle or something like that. And these are the other collaborators in Florida. Sorry for taking almost in time. Thank you.
has influences, whether it's all-to-all local or scale three and that type of thing?
Different diseases have different networks. What I found is that the number of parameters is huge in the sense is really because what is important is not only the topology, but for instance the number of super spreaders. There is a sort of 20-80% rule in which 20% of the nodes are really bringing 80% of epidemics. So it's not only the scale 3. And what is perhaps interesting is that I'm using a realistic one. There are some scale 3 networks, for instance, one on sensor contact in Sweden that you can download and try to play. What I'm doing is to do something very methodological. So first I started with a regular lattice, and I'm trying to devise all the properties that is already quite a lot, overlapping a sort of Domain-Kinzel model and adding this social thing. Then a small word in the sort of Strogatz words, in which I am trying to think, I'm trying to devise, for instance, the connectivity, probably is this. I'm trying to insert different number of long-range contacts. And then for now, about the scale 3, I'm trying non-assortative. And then going to this assortative and so on. It's pretty a large number of things to try, and I'm still at the beginning. I thought that it's quite complementary of to investigating the disease itself on a single organism to try to extend to multiple. But for sure, it's quite difficult. What I'm now focusing, and I think is really the core of the system biology, is to try to make use of heterogeneous information. There is quite a lot of information that is available, not only on network contacts, but is also trying to fit medical and molecular biology information. And that, I think, is the real essence of finding something really good from this kind of modeling.
Can you take a lot of questions?
Yes.